funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the hardest thing you've ever done, and would you do it again and again and again? In her mid-30s, Roz Savage had a lucrative career, a handsome husband, and a beautiful home. In short, she had everything except the happiness those things were supposed to bring her. So she decided to leave it all behind for a life of adventure. She explored Incan ruins in Peru, ran marathons in New York and London, and most radically of all, became the first woman in history to enter the Atlantic rowing race as a solo competitor. She covered 3,000 miles in 103 days, writing about the journey in her 2009 book, Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean. And then she followed it up with record-breaking solo expeditions across the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Roz Savage is in town to speak tonight to the Brinker International Forum's National Geographic Live event at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. We're thrilled that she could make time to be with us today. Roz, welcome back to THINK.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Chris.
Did it take a while in your life for you to start saying, I am an adventurer, to use that label and apply it to your life?
Absolutely, yes. I think I'd always been an armchair adventurer. Like many people, I enjoyed reading books about polar explorers and mountaineers and round-the-world yachtsmen. But when I looked in the bathroom mirror, I did not see a potential adventurer looking back at me. It seemed like most of these adventurers were, to start off with, male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And had a big bushy beard, and you know, I just didn't seem to qualify. And so I think what really transformed that for me was when I met a couple who had rowed the Atlantic in the 2001 Atlantic rowing race. And he looked like your archetypal adventurer, 6'5", 220 pounds, big strapping guy. And his wife was just about my size. And they had set out from the Canaries to row these 3,000 miles. And within the first week, it became very apparent that he just was not cut out for this at all. He was just completely incapacitated by fear to the extent where he was lying in the cabin, curled up in the fetal position and just completely unable to carry on. And he had to be lifted off the boat while she carried on and continued the crossing alone. And I think that helped me to realise that you didn't have to be 6'5" and male in order to do this kind of thing. And it's funny because obviously I didn't grow any taller, didn't sprout a beard overnight. It was purely that my belief system had changed. And I thought, well, why not? What have I got to lose by trying? And yeah, I suppose now I actually feel worthy of the label of adventurer. And I firmly believe that adventurers can be made. They don't have to be born.
Do you think there's value to being afraid often and having to push past that?
Yes, I do. I was petrified when I set out across the Atlantic. I thought I was really well prepared. I'd done so much research and spoken to so many ocean rowers and read every book and every article. But I don't think there's anything that can fully prepare you for the actual reality of being out there alone on the ocean, especially at night. And I suppose I had gone out there wanting to test my limits. I'd wanted to get outside of my comfort zone and find out what I was really capable of when I tested myself. And I'd sort of overlooked the fact that getting outside of your comfort zone is by definition going to be uncomfortable. Oops. and it was psychologically and physically extremely uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But over the course of time, you realise that there's a limit to how long you can carry on being scared for. And after a couple of weeks of being constantly scared, I just thought, well, I've been scared for 2 weeks now and I haven't died yet. So maybe I'll manage to carry on not dying and we'll see how this goes. And gradually, your comfort zone does become larger. It does grow to encompass those uncomfortable new experiences that you're forcing yourself to go through.
After 15,000 miles, do you struggle to stay challenged?
I think I've taken the ocean rowing about as far as I can for now. I've spent more time at sea more time at sea in a rowboat than any other woman alive. I think that I have personally have learned about myself a lot over the last few years, and I think that it's time to move on to something new, a different kind of challenge. The underlying reason for the ocean rowing has always been my environmental mission, and I'd really like to start focusing on that a bit more specifically now. So I do have new challenges lined up that I'm sure will stretch me in new and unfamiliar ways, but no longer on the open ocean.
Let's talk about the environmental, what you witnessed while you were out there. I mean, did you have you seen garbage in the oceans? Obviously, you understand the importance of keeping them vital and healthy.
Yes. When I was rowing from San Francisco to Hawaii, I was on the outskirts of the North Pacific garbage patch, which is allegedly between one and two times the size of Texas. It's a bit difficult to say exactly how big it is because, like, most things that are centred in a particular location, it kind of becomes more dispersed towards the outer edges
sure.
of it. So
mm-hmm.
you can't say, oh, now I'm inside the North Pacific garbage patch and take one step to the right and now I'm outside of it.
And it's not like a flotilla of trash.
It's not. It's not a floating island, as some reports would describe it, or certainly not from what I have seen. Mm. What I have seen is, on a calm day, a suspension of lots of tiny pieces of plastic distributed throughout the water column. And occasionally I do see bigger items like a floating drinks bottle or a mooring buoy or a massive net or something like that. But mostly the plastic does break down. It doesn't biodegrade, but it photodegrades into these little pieces. But in a way, they're more dangerous because they get into the food chain at a lower level because smaller fish can eat them.
Yeah.
And so when the chemicals get leached out from the plastic, you know, there's been a lot of publicity around BPAs being leached out from plastic bottles and food containers into the food. Well, the same thing happens in the ocean. BPAs leach out from the plastic into the water. So it is a significant problem. And it's a bit scary to think that plastics only went into mass production, what, in the last 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even when I was a child, and I'm not that old, I can
soda
remember a much
glass.
Less plasticky
yeah.
world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or we used to have deposits on cans and bottles. I don't think you have that in the US, do you?
In some states, but not in Texas.
Right. Yeah, we don't have it in the UK either. And if we could just provide a bit more incentive for people to make sure that these things are recycled, then I think we could massively reduce the amount of plastic getting out there into the world. And, you know, it's ugly as well. I was quite shocked driving around the south of Britain earlier this year when all the leaves are off the trees and mm-hmm. the bushes. You can really see just how much plastic there is blowing around, bags caught in trees. It's really unsightly and makes me very sad. So this year I'm actually launching a new project, initially in the UK, but hopefully to roll out more globally later on. We're calling it Trash Mobs, a bit like flash mobs, mm-hmm. but trashier. And the idea is that I'll be kayaking along the south coast of Britain and inviting people to come and join me for beach cleanups and waterside cleanups and see if we can stop some of that plastic rubbish from ending up in the oceans.
Well, it's really hard to avoid as a consumer. You know, a lot of people now carry their own shopping bags, but you go to the grocery store and fill your own shopping bags with a lot of products packaged in plastic that you simply can't purchase without that.
That's right. And it is a terrible challenge. I have real moral dilemmas in the supermarket about
yeah.
am I going to buy this this organic thing or that thing with no additives or that thing that's got less packaging on it? And somewhere way down that list, I think, oh, well, do I actually like that food? so I do understand it is complex. And we will also be gathering signatures on a petition this summer asking the British government to do more to work with retailers and manufacturers to reduce the amount of plastic packaging on things, because so much of it just isn't really necessary. And a lot of it, I think, consumers generally would prefer not to have, like, that really annoying packaging on things like SD cards or
yeah.
USB memory sticks, where you're buying a tiny little item that comes in big plastic, that really tough plastic packaging that you need a serious pair of scissors to cut through. Drives me nuts.
Well, yeah, and the interesting thing is, too, I think you're right, Roz, that a lot of people would be just as happy without the packaging. But it's almost like, I don't know what you guys do in the UK, but here we have recycling programs that are finally successful now that everyone is given a special can and it's curbside and no one has to go to any particular effort. And I don't, it's not that people don't care, but they're busy and they've got things going on. I mean, I wonder what you think is the right role for the government as compared with individuals who really want to make a difference and whether individuals on their own are enough.
I think ideally it would come from bottom up and top down. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think any of us like being told what to do. But there again, a lot of us want to do the right thing, if only it were made a little bit easier for us. So it's great if you've got curbside collection and all you have to do is to remember to keep your recyclables separate from the rest of the stuff. That's great if you don't have to try and find the time to drive to a local recycling centre. Brilliant. And also, of course, it's more efficient in terms of fuel. Mm-hmm. If a truck can come along and collect everybody's recycling instead of everybody individually having to drive to the local centre. But I think that politicians and governments need to know that it's a vote winner, that people actually do want to be helped to do the right thing. And so I think in many ways it does come down to the individual. I suppose I'm all in favour of controlling the things that I can. And so I suppose we, as individuals, we do have a voice. We can make it heard. And we really need to do that. I'm a real believer in the power of the pound, as we would call it in Britain. I don't know what the dollar equivalent would be. That every time we buy something or choose how to dispose of something, we are casting a vote for the kind of future that we want.
Money talks.
It does, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really up to us to cast those future votes wisely.
Did it occur to you when you started out with the rowing projects in particular that this would give you a bully pulpit? Or is that something that when you began to get all this attention, you thought, well, I ought to do something with this?
It was actually that first one. Mm-hmm. That around that time when I turned my life around and left the corporate world and really set out to try and find a more fulfilling and happier way of life. It was around that very formative time that I kind of got green, had my environmental epiphany. And with all the zeal of the convert, I think I was really horrified that I'd been so oblivious to my own personal environmental impact for so long. I just hadn't even thought about it. You know, I threw something away and it conveniently vanished.
Disappeared, right.
Yeah. Exactly. And I never thought about where it was really actually ending up and how long it was going to stay there. And so I thought, what can I do to bring more attention to this? If I've been oblivious to this and I'm supposedly well-educated and well-informed, but I just hadn't thought about it. So I really was trying to find a platform to get the word out there. And so when the idea to row across oceans popped into my head one sunny day, I thought, well, this is absolutely perfect. You know, here's a way that I can go out, have my big adventure, a way that I can test myself, test my self-reliance, and hopefully do something to inspire action on environmental issues as well.
My guest is adventurer and environmental activist Roz Savage. She's also the author of the book, Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean, that was published in 2009. She's down to speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum National Geographic Live event that takes place at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a writer, adventurer, and environmental activist Roz Savage. Her 2009 book is called Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean. She's in town to speak tonight in Dallas to the Brinker International Forum National Geographic Live event that takes place at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I've been curious about this since the last time we talked, Roz. When you change your life as radically as you did, do you also in some way, did you have to change a lot of your friends? I mean, had you been hanging around with people who had very different ideas of sort of the right way to live a life?
That's a really great question. I think I've actually been really, really lucky that people who were best friends in my old life are still really great friends now. But at the same time, I've added a lot of new friends, particularly in other countries around the world in the course of my travels. It was actually the fear of what would happen in terms of my personal relationships, I think, held me back for so long when I was quietly dying in that corporate life for 11 years. I think I was really afraid to step off the tracks in case my friends wouldn't speak to me anymore, in case they thought I'd just lost the plot. And I just wasn't willing to shake things up quite that much. But then I really did reach a bit of a crisis point where I thought, I'm just going to explode if I don't get out of this office cubicle. I have to go and do something different. And who knows, maybe some of my friends did think I'd lost the plot for a while. But I'm happy to say that I have retained and maintained a lot of those friendships and relationships. And I don't know if they just kind of regard me as their eccentric oddball friend who goes off and rows across oceans. But whenever we get together, it's just a really good time. And it hasn't really created any division at all. I'm still me.
You must also hear from people who say, I don't know that I could do what you did, but you represent exactly how I feel.
Yes, there are a lot of people who say, oh, I'd love to do that, but, you know, there's always a but. And some of the buts, you know, are very valid ones. Certainly if I'd have had children, that would have made life a lot more complicated. But sometimes it's things like, well, but I've got the higher purchase payments to make, or but I've got the mortgage. And I go, well, you know, I used to have those things as well. And I just became really determined that I was going to simplify my life and give myself more time to focus on the things that would make me feel happy and fulfilled and the things that I believe are really important, like my relationships, where are we going in the future, stewardship towards the earth, these kinds of things. So I think I'm a real believer in the concept of tipping points in just so many different applications. And I think this is one that when you want to make a change in your life, you're adding more and more straws onto that side of the balance in favour of change. And sometimes it will take 100 straws on that side against only one straw to keep things the same before the scales actually tip, just because change is hard. It's part of human nature, I think, to be change averse. But maybe eventually more people will find that impetus to change. As a parallel, you know, I used to smoke. Confession time. I used to smoke.
I have to say, I would not have guessed that.
Well, thank you. And I can remember writing long lists of reasons I should stop smoking. And, you know, there would be 20 good reasons to stop against maybe 2 reasons to carry on. But that is what many human beings go through when we're trying to make a positive change in our lives. It's not easy, but it can be done. And in fact, finally, it was a fairly spurious reason that finally tipped the balance in favour of quitting smoking. And that was, it got to a year before the start of the Atlantic rowing race. And I just thought, there's something deeply incongruous about me doing all this training, spending all this time in the gym, and then popping home for a cigarette. it just doesn't look right. And that was really what tipped the balance. And I stopped. And now when I look back, I go, why did that ever seem like a good idea? So change is possible.
The other thing that's very brave about you is that you write about everything going on in your life. Maybe not everything, but you're very candid on your blog. You've written several books, not just the one that we've mentioned today. Is that something that was that a hurdle for you to say, okay, I'm not only am I going to do this, but I'm going to share the stuff that's working really well, the things that are not going so well?
It has been challenging. I found it especially excruciating to talk about the very personal stuff around the end of my marriage.
Yeah.
You know, being British, we don't really like to kind of wash our dirty linen in public, as the phrase goes.
You were very gracious about your ex-husband, though. You, as I recall, the writing was not about his flaws.
Absolutely, yes.
He may disagree, but
to the extent that some people go, so why did you leave him if he was that perfect? I go, well, you know, of course I'm going to say nice things about him because we still have a great relationship and mm-hmm. I don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. But, you know, nobody ever truly knows what goes on behind closed doors, do they? So it has been a bit of a challenge for me to bare my soul to quite that extent. But I also felt like it was important. Because I do have these bigger messages that I'm trying to get across, not just the environmental ones, but about trying to give people the courage to step out there and to make their dreams come true rather than waiting till they get to the end of their lives and they're going, oh, well, that didn't go quite according to plan, did it? And in order to do that, I felt like I had to make my life an open book. And that hasn't always been easy, but I think hopefully it does mean that I come across as being a bit more human and mm-hmm. a bit more normal. And it's easier for people to see, well, hey, she struggled. You know, she had to work hard to become that happy or to have this amazingly adventurous life that she has now. There were some spectacular failures along the way and there were lots of moments of self-doubt and worry and fear. But, you know, she was sufficiently motivated to get on through that. So I hope that by sharing all of that, maybe it works as a little bit of a how to change your life kind of manual, I hope.
You know, there's interesting research about regret that we've covered on this show. And people at the end of their lives, they don't tend to regret the things they've done. They tend to regret the things they never did.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that was what really brought it home to me that I needed to make this big change in my life. I think we might have discussed last time, but I'll just do a little recap of my obituary exercise did when I was trying to figure out what was wrong with this picture. Why wasn't that corporate, reasonably secure, reasonably well-paid life working for me? I sat down one day and wrote two versions of my obituary, the one that I wanted and the one that I was actually heading for if I carried on as I was. And when I saw how very different they were, I realised that if I carried on as I was, then I was going to get to the end of my life with regrets about the things that I hadn't even tried. And an interesting thing about that was when I was writing my fantasy obituary, I thought about the people that I really admired. And they weren't necessarily the people who had succeeded. They were the people who had tried. Mm-hmm. The people who'd gone out there and just given it their best shot. And maybe they would succeed, maybe they would fail. Often you could do all the right things, but still fail anyway, just because the timing wasn't right or whatever. But at least they had the guts to try. And in doing that exercise, as well as identifying what my fantasy life might look like, I also gave myself permission to fail.
Mm-hmm. That's a big deal, especially for someone
really
who's been very successful.
Yeah, I was almost cursed by early success. You know, I did pretty well at school and that had made me afraid of failure.
Yeah.
I was worried about what people would think of me, and especially because I was trying out this very radically new lifestyle. But then when I said, you know what, it's actually okay to fail. I love that phrase in the Rudyard Kipling poem, If, where he talks about the twin imposters of victory and defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so true. Success and failure are sometimes so closely linked. There's another great quote from one of my favourite quotees, Winston Churchill, where he said, "Success is the ability to go from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm." And that's pretty much how I feel on the ocean. Most of the days that I'm out there, I feel like I'm failing. Why am I not going faster? Why am I not having a better time? It's just there are so many challenges. But then on the final day, when I actually reach dry land, and I go, hurrah, you know, after all those failures, I actually succeeded. I actually got there in one piece. And so, good old Winston. I think those are fantastic words of wisdom.
Adventurer and author Roz Savage is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first on the phone to Lisa in Dallas. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Hi, Lisa.
Can you hear me? I'm on the road back to Dallas. I wanted to invite Roz to come for a row this afternoon at Bachman Lake at the Dallas Rowing Club. I'm the secretary of the club and a crew coach as well, and it's going to be a pretty afternoon. We'd love for you to come look at our lake, and you could identify some of our trash as well.
That is kind of you.
I also had a technical question. I wondered if you could describe your boat, the size, the length, your oars, how the endurance for it, how many hours you would row at a time, how you would rest, how many strokes per minute, you know, all of those things that rowers would like to hear.
Well, we'll get answers for you, Lisa. And anything that you don't hear described are on Roz's fantastic blog, which I believe is rozsavage.com. Mm-hmm. So we'll get some answers, and then anything else you can check out over there.
Okay. I've been writing notes here. The boat, first of all. The boat is 23 feet long and 6 feet wide. And so it's a lot wider than your traditional rowing racing shell. It's got a cabin at each end. The aft cabin is for sleeping in and the forward cabin is for storage. And the rowing position is in the middle. The rowing position doesn't look so different from what you would probably have in one of your boats, Lisa. It's got a sliding seat, and I actually use wooden oars now because on the Atlantic I broke all four of my carbon fibre oars and I wasn't going to let that happen again. So now I have oars made out of solid Oregon ash.
We should let people know you had to duct tape these things together and use boat hooks and whatever to get something you could use.
That's right, yeah. Yes, it was a bit like a scrap heap challenge. Just had to look around the boat and figure out what I had handy that I could use as splints on these broken, bent oars. As for rowing shifts, I've experimented with all kinds of rowing shifts. Initially, I aimed to row 16 hours a day when I set out on the Atlantic, but I found that was just too much. I think psychologically more than physically, it was just too daunting. So over the years, depending on how motivated I'm feeling, I do between 8 and 12 hours of rowing a day. On the Atlantic, I would do 3 hours on and then 1 hour off, repeat four times a day, and then get as much sleep as I could overnight. I did try doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off around the clock, as the pairs rowers do. They tend to alternate one person on the oars while the other person rests. But I found it just unbelievably difficult to get myself out of my bunk at 3 a.m. to go rowing. Mm-hmm. Just wasn't high on my list of priorities at that time of night.
I think we can all relate to that.
So now I tend to do more of my rowing during daylight hours and then overnight just try and get as much rest as I can and give my poor aching body a bit of a break. I tend to do a fairly low racing, probably about 20 strokes per minute. So, and in every hour, I would take a 10-minute break. So that would make about 1,000 oar strokes per hour. And on the Atlantic, when my stereo broke quite early on, I actually would just count my strokes to keep myself amused. It was desperate times, I tell you. So I would count up to 500 and then I would count back down from 500 for 3.5 months.
You lost your satellite phone for part of that trip.
It broke, yes, yeah. 24 days before the end of the crossing. And I wasn't able to fix it. So, yes, I had no comms at all for the last 24 days. My poor mum was just faintly reassured by being able to watch the little blip being sent back by my transponder. Mm-hmm. This was just an automatic unit that was sending back my position via satellite, but I couldn't use it to actually send a message. It was literally just sending back my latitude and longitude. But at least that was enough to reassure my mother that the boat was moving a little bit more purposefully than it would have been if I'd fallen overboard.
Is it sort of a relief to be alone when you're on your own? I mean, you strike me as a very social person and yet so comfortable when you are all alone in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, I regard my life as being strangely well balanced, although it is balanced between two very far removed extremes. I do go from extreme solitude to extreme gregariousness, and I really enjoy both. I think I can really appreciate each because I know that this too will pass, mm-hmm. that after a certain amount of time on dry land that there will be the solitude again. And now that I'm pretty much hanging up my oars, it's going to be quite interesting to see how this pans out, whether I might need to book myself onto Vipassana meditation retreats or something like that in order to have my solitary time. Because I do think that is quite important. I think when we look back even 100 years, a lot more of us would have spent more time alone, mm-hmm. working out in the fields or walking to places before we all had cars. And I think it's really valuable time just to have that quietness for a while when you can sort of reflect and think about things and just have some time off from talking and listening, being bombarded with all this information as we are, even if we're not with people. Maybe we've got the TV on or the radio on.
And we're being, nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that at all. But there's all this constant flow of input.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite nice just not to have that for a little while, because amazing things start sort of bubbling up from inside, kind of little insights and things that you never even knew that you knew. I find when I'm on the ocean, my dreams pop up a lot of surprises, like people that I hadn't thought about in decades.
Suddenly they're in your mind and you're processing all that.
It's quite cool.
Roz Savage is with us. She's a writer, environmental activist, and adventurer. Her 2009 book is called Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean. She's in town to speak tonight to the Brinker International Forum National Geographic Live event that takes place at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Roz Savage. She holds 4 world records and is the only woman ever to row solo across the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Indian Oceans. Her 2009 book is still in print. It's called Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean. She'll be speaking tonight at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas to the Brinker International Forum National Geographic Live event. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next on the phone to Peter in Fort Worth. Hello, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Hi, yes, Peter.
My question was, I was just wondering if she was using any type of celestial navigation or was it GPS she was using for navigating across the ocean? And then my second question was, I know she said she slept during the night. Did she have some sort of beacon where other ships could see her so they would run over her small craft?
Great questions. I have learned how to do celestial navigation, but it would be very difficult to measure the angle between the sun or any other celestial body and the horizon when you're standing on the deck of a very tippy little rowboat. So I am a huge fan of GPS. I had 5 GPSs on my boat last year on the Indian Ocean, which is just as well because 4 of them broke. 5 months at sea when it's pretty rough conditions, the salt water just gets into everything. Mm-hmm. So Yes, GPS is great. In fact, I had a funny experience when I was doing the first stage of the Pacific. Day two, my GPS chart plotter broke. This, like, the proper marine GPS mm-hmm. that would actually show my route. But luckily, on board, I had the TomTom sat-nav out of my car.
Hmm. Really?
Oh, that's... Well, because I was going to sell my car in California. Uh-huh. And just at the last minute, I thought, oh, no, what am I going to do with the TomTom? Oh, well, I'll just have to stick it on the boat because I don't have anywhere else to put it. And I ended up navigating the whole way to Hawaii using my car GPS. Well, it gave latitude and longitude, and that was all I really needed because there aren't really any islands between the mainland and Hawaii, apart from the Farallones, and they're pretty obvious. So, yes, GPS, definitely, all the way. Although it is quite nice to know that I could use Celestial if all the satellites suddenly fell out of the sky. As for not getting run over by container ships in the night, yes, I do have a radar enhancer called a CME, which is supposed to make me look a bit bigger on the radar of any passing ships. I'm not sure how effective it is because waves can also create interference on radar. And because my boat's so small, the waves wouldn't have to be very big for my boat just to kind of disappear into that general interference. But I suppose it makes me feel a little bit better anyway. And it does sound an alarm if it detects a radar apparatus within a certain radius of me. So far, so good. Haven't had any terribly close encounters with large ships.
Is there, I mean, the effect on your body has to be interesting when you are exercising for hours on end every day for 5 month stretches, and then you come back to the real world where even if you make time to get to the gym and go for a run, I mean, it can't be more than an hour or two a day.
Rowing across an ocean is probably the easiest diet you will ever do because it requires no willpower. All you have to do is leave port with only healthy food on board. I typically lose 25, 30 pounds mm-hmm. on each crossing. The trouble is then when I get back to dry land and caramel lattes and wine and cakes and cookies, all that weight pretty quickly comes back with interest. I probably could keep the weight off if I carried on rowing for 12 hours a day, but it's not a great lifestyle.
You feel too thin by the end? You must feel too thin by the end of these trips.
No, I feel fantastic. And of course, there's the all over suntan as well. Uh-huh. I suppose I have been pretty thin at times. I know when I arrived in Hawaii, shortly after that, I tested at 11% body fat, which is pretty low for a woman, mm-hmm. Probably at the lower end of what's healthy. But it is nice for the 5 minutes that it lasts.
All the short skirts you've got come out.
Absolutely. All the skimpy shorts, yes. But then, yes, by now I'm into the kind of the big figure concealing sweaters
well,
at this time of year.
It's pretty clear that that's not necessary. But you say all over suntan. You actually found that clothes are an impediment when you're out there?
Well, they tend to get salty and sweaty. And obviously mm-hmm. my laundry facilities are fairly limited out
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
A bucket. it just makes practical sense to wear as little as possible. So usually that is a sun hat and a pair of rowing gloves and not much more. It's not that I'm naturally an exhibitionist.
No one can see you when you're
well,
out there.
Exactly. If there was anybody within 1,000 miles of me, then yes, I would be wearing a lot more clothing. But as it is, it's actually it is quite liberating. I suppose when you're out there on the ocean, you do feel very much like you're just another animal. You're just a part of nature. You realise that you don't get any special privileges just for being a human being, for having a larger brain and an opposing thumb. 20-foot waves don't discriminate on that basis. And the wearing minimal clothing, I think, really contributes to that. It's kind of like going back to a much more natural, very simple way of living where you're really just trying to make sure you've got enough food to eat and enough water to drink and that you're getting a bit closer to where you want to go. There's something really quite beautiful about that. So, yes, I don't think I miss the nudity when I'm back on dry land, but there is something quite freeing about it on the ocean.
Any concern about not so much being run over by another ship, but about pirates or people who might be out there that might do you harm?
This was a very big concern last year for the Indian Ocean. Yeah. Around this time last year, I was planning my route from Australia to Mauritius. And initially, actually, I'd wanted to go to Mumbai on the west coast of India. But in order to get there, to work with the winds and the currents, I was going to have to loop a long way west, which would have taken me perilously close to the coast of Somalia. Mm-hmm. And it was just around about this time last year that four American missionaries, sadly, were shot in the Arabian Sea by pirates there. So that was a real wake-up call for me. And I realised that probably was just going to be too risky. So I changed my route to go to Mauritius instead, staying well south of the equator. And I also decided that I wasn't going to post my position online. Every other year, people have been able to look at a map on my website to see exactly where I am and how much progress I've made in the last 24 hours. And it's usually the most viewed page on my website. But it just seemed to be tempting fate to make that information so available. I mean, I know that I'm not worth anything. I don't have any money to pay a ransom. My mum wouldn't have money to pay a ransom. But it just seemed to... I just didn't want to be constantly looking over my shoulder, yeah, worrying about this, because it...
There's such an irony to that, by the way, that it's people you have to worry about more than the conditions of the ocean or animals out there or something.
Absolutely. I mean, situations are challenging enough out there as it is without that human factor thrown in. But yeah, I would take my chance with 20-foot waves over pirates toting AK-47s any day of the week. Thank you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Paul in Fort Worth. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
Hello, Paul.
My question is, it has to do with your sense of place. Mm. When you think about things like home, when you're constantly away from what we typically, us kind of mortals, consider to be home, and you're constantly away from it, does it broaden your sense of place on, you know, where you are at any given time, your place on the planet? It's kind of, you touch on that somewhat when you were talking about, you know, how the waves don't discriminate, that kind of thing, but just your sense of where you are as a person on the planet.
That is a great question. In fact, we were just talking about this in the green room earlier, where people were amazed to hear that I haven't paid rent anywhere since 2005 because I'm just, yeah, as you say, perpetually on the move. I sometimes describe myself as a homeless person, but actually I think I would prefer to say global citizen. I'm very fortunate in that I've got many wonderful friends around the world who accommodate me, sometimes at very short notice. It is quite an amazing time to be a global citizen. I don't think that I could have done this a while ago before the advent of email and mobile phones. I mean, I really can be at home anywhere and nowhere. And I do find there's something quite beautiful about that. I love that sort of connection to the planet as a whole. One of the most... amazing things that I've seen in the technological sense was the first time that I saw Google Earth. Hmm. And in the Googleplex, in the lobby there, they have a rotating Earth that shows, it has streams of light going out into space from the Earth, showing how many people are Googling in all these locations around the world. And to see that, just this one aspect of human activity reflected in this very visual form, just made me feel incredibly emotionally attached to that blue marble spinning in space, even though this was just a technological representation of it. And I think also having rode around most of the world now, I have a much stronger sense than I used to have of just what the size of the planet is.
Mm-hmm. Probably better than most people will ever have.
Well, I think from a plane, it's a lot harder to really get that sense of distance and place because you're sort of magically whisked from one place to another. And even if you look out of the window the whole way across, I think it's just almost too easy. You don't really, it's difficult to really appreciate the scale. And in some ways the world is a very big place, but in other ways, I'm sort of surprised how small it is. Mm-hmm. When, you know, one small woman can row around most of it at 2 miles an hour in one lifetime, you realise that actually it's not infinite. And I think for coming back to my environmental thing here, I think for so long we've tended to regard the Earth as being so vast and human numbers as being so small mm-hmm. that we haven't really believed that we could make an appreciable difference to the Earth. But actually, the Earth isn't as big as we think it is, and there is a limit to how much abuse it can take. And I think we're kind of hitting that limit right now.
When you sit next to someone on an airplane, do you avoid explaining what it is? When people say, well, what do you do for a living? Is that polite opening to the conversation? I mean, you won't be allowed to shut up for the entire flight, right, if you tell somebody what you do?
Yes, I do have to be a little bit careful about those conversations. I do sometimes wonder whether just to say, well, I'm an accountant.
End of conversation.
But I suppose if I do get talking with somebody and if the question comes up, then it's part of my mission in life, I suppose, like I was saying earlier, to make my life an open book. So I would feel like I was sort of betraying that mission mm-hmm. if I didn't actually confess to what I do. And it does tend to get, as you would expect, a certain amount of reaction from people. It's generally a positive thing. And, you know, I've made some great friends on planes, mm-hmm. but I don't tend to kind of volunteer the information unless specifically asked, just because, you know, I don't want to seem like I'm showing off.
So I know that recently, this is a big year in Great Britain. It's the anniversary of the Queen, and you had the chance to meet her. And what did she think about your adventures?
Well, I suppose the Queen, after 86 years, has pretty much seen everything and met everybody. So she was lovely. But actually, I have to confess, the highlight of that day for me was really in the afternoon at a kind of press preview event when I got to meet Sir David Attenborough, mm-hmm. who is the legendary BBC presenter of so many natural history programmes over the years. He's actually about the same age as the Queen. I think he's 85 now. But still, that completely instantly recognizable voice.
Yeah, is he exactly what you'd expect him to be?
Oh, he is such a sweetie. I just mm-hmm. wanted to adopt him. And when he heard what I did, he literally, you know, he let his jaw drop. And we ended up having this lovely conversation. I'm a huge fan of his. I think no matter how hard I work in my lifetime on behalf of the environment, I think he, just through those incredible BBC programmes, has probably done more than anybody to really nurture an appreciation of our amazing planet, our natural world. And I'm so grateful to him for that. So that was probably the highlight of 2011, if not of my life.
Well, that's saying something. Roz, we will continue following your adventure. So thank you so much for stopping in.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Roz Savage will speak tonight to the Brinker International Forum's National Geographic Live event at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.